Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 4. And then we'll have our friends over at Bradley Place, WGN TV, on here from 4 to 5. And then at 5 o'clock, Bob Surratt is your morning drive host. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. Who requested that, Tom?
That is coming to us from Glenn.
Glenn. All right. Wild Card Wednesday. Yeah, Wild Card Wednesday. 312-981-7200. All right. So we love talking to our next guest. He's a regular on the show. Author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society. He's a space expert. If you guys have any questions or comments about the world of space and you want to get in here, you can text us or call us at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And let's welcome Rod Pyle back to the show. Rod, how are you?
Hey, I'm good, Nick. How are you?
I'm not bad. I'm not bad. So how you been? You've been busy, huh?
I have been busy. I finally looked at my pedometer when I got back from the Consumer Electronics Show today, and we walked 9 miles.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And the Consumer Electronics Show, tell everybody, well, first of all, tell everybody about you and the background and all that.
So I'm a space writer and journalist and an author, and I got interested in it when I was a kid because I was born just a little bit before NASA was created, so I got to grow up with all those great programs flying off to the moon. And for me, there was just no greater adventure. You know, I was just a fanatic about it. And of course, back then, you know, by between 69 and 72, some of these missions were flying every 2 months, and you could watch them on TV, at least the parts they'd show. So that was just almost too good to be true. So then went off to college and eventually decided, okay, I'm not going to make it as a scientist, so I'm going to get in a communications racket. And after trying a lot of different things, I finally settled on writing about space, and it's been absolutely sensational.
Yeah, great. And you've written some really, really great books. And Ad Astra magazine, of which you are editor-in-chief, how's that going?
That is going great. That is the publication, as you said, the National Space Society. It's a quarterly. We do it in print. And we do try to do a special edition every year or two, which is about 100 pages, and then the normal one's about 64. The nice thing is we hardly have any ads. So
yeah.
You're not going through tearing out the little, you know, little tear out things that you got to do for subscriptions on the magazines, and you're not looking at an ad every other page. There's maybe 4 or 5 ads throughout the whole thing. So it's just packed with material, and I am the editor, main writer, photo editor, kind of name it. I've got a copy editor and a managing editor in me, so we get to do it all ourselves, and that's sensational.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And so you're obviously keeping busy. You mentioned that you're at Consumer Electronics Show. Tell me about that and how that's going. You walked 9 miles.
Yeah. So I'd never been to CES before. I thought I had, but I realized I was thinking about NAB, the TV technology show that they do here, which is, I think, about half the size or something. So CES is once a year, and it's anything consumer electronics that you can imagine. Unbelievable. It took up, it attracts between 180 and 200,000 people, so Vegas gets very expensive for a week.
Yeah.
And it took up, I think, this year, 5 hotels.
That sounds about right.
Including the convention center. Yeah, so you kind of dip in there, and I'm only here for a day because I have to fly out to Houston tomorrow. But you walk around, and I spent most of the day, I mean, I had a talk at 4 o'clock, but the rest of the day I spent looking at like 1.5 halls, just kind of dipping in. Mostly I was looking at robotics and the AI stuff and, you know, looking for space applications of that. And it's funny, you know, in some stuff, it's just jaw-dropping at how far it's come, like the robotic arms that we see in car assembly plants don't look that different than they always have, but what's powering them and what's driving them in terms of the software and the sophistication and the AI behind it and being able to guess what's needed next and figure things out on its own is where so much of the work is happening. So it's another one of these things that we see that isn't, the advances aren't scaling in the way we always thought they would.
Yeah.
You know, you always think, okay, the arm's going to be bigger and more exotic looking, and of course there is that too, but an awful lot of it's just in the detail, you know, in the refining of the software and designing more intelligence behind this. And I didn't even get into the part that had all the scary AI stuff in it. They did have a bunch of drones, and we've all seen those. They had them ranging from little things you can carry in a pocket and toss in the air to one that would carry, I think, 8 or 12 passengers.
Wow.
These massive, like 6 mega rotors off the sides, Uber. had their passenger drone on display. And again, you know, these things just get smarter and smarter to the point that human intervention is not going to be a thing in 5 or 10 years. So pretty astonishing stuff.
Yeah.
Really something.
It was really funny. I was watching Stephen Colbert from the other night, and they did a report on some of the stuff that's at the Consumer Electronics Show. And one of the things that he, and of course, this is going to be, you know, goofy stuff because it's Stephen Colbert and irreverent stuff.
Right.
So,
but he's smart, though.
Oh, yeah. No, he's great. He's great. But he did it. So they did this bit where he was talking about some of the stuff that's at the Consumer Electronics Show. And one of the things that they discovered was there's a lot of, if you mentioned, there's a lot of robotics at the convention. There's a lot of robotics. And they busted out a robot that's called your poop time pal. And it's a robot that's designed to bring you a roll of toilet paper if you need it. It's a real thing.
It's a little single purpose, but it certainly does fill a need. There's a keynote yesterday that was given by the CEO of Samsung and some of his coworkers. And one of the things they showed off, and I was kind of distracted because I had to answer an email at the same time, but it looks like a hockey puck, except it's kind of round, and it basically is designed, I guess, to monitor your state of well-being, and it follows you around asking questions. How do you feel? What are you doing? You know, what do you need?
Really?
And, I mean, my response to look at this is I would kick that thing to the wall in about 5 minutes. But, you know, they were very proud of it because it's smart, and I think we're kind of at that weird cusp of, okay, you know, we've come up with the ability to do X, but do we really want X or do we want Y or double L? You know, what is it we want these things to do? What I don't want them doing is following you around asking me questions all day. They had another one that this company obviously put a huge amount of money into. It was a Chinese company, as a lot of them were. And it's a cute little robot, comes up to bite your waist, and it's got this, it's shaped vaguely like a kind of a cross between a dumpy person and a Dalek out of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And it has two little flippers for arms, so they can't grip anything. They just move back and forth, and it rolls around, and it's got a little round screen with the face of what looks like a cartoony, maybe 8-year-old girl, and it just smiles and winks and says, like, goofy stuff like you'd see in anime. And so I stood there for a long time, so I thought, there's got to be something I'm missing here, because one thing that a lot of these companies don't do well is make it immediately apparent what the hell you're looking at.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, put up a banner that tells me what this does other than be irritating all day. And I waited and waited, and I couldn't get it. I finally asked the guy, and he said, well, yeah, that's what it does. It's a companion.
That's it?
Okay, yeah. It's, you know, if I'm going to have a fembot around, that's not the kind of companion I'm looking for. It's a little bit of this kind of creepy, you know, Catholic schoolgirl thing happening. And I thought, okay, so we got a long way to go there. But it, you know, as a technology demo, it's quite cool. And that's what this whole show is. You know, it's like, okay, what's on the cutting edge of stuff that's available to all of us?
Right.
So it's not really industry to industry. So, I mean, you've seen this stuff before.
I have,
It's astonishing, but after about 5 hours, you just want to sit down and kind of get away from it because it's just overwhelming. It's noisy and flash. It's like all of Las Vegas made miniature and jammed into a little tiny hall with robots, you know? So it's pretty intense.
It is. I mean, I remember when they used to tour around, because now it's just an annual thing, and there's only one.
Well, what city could do this besides Las Vegas, really?
Well, we used to do it here. There used to be a Consumer Electronics Show here, and I used to go every year, and it was at McCormick Place, and they would take up pretty much all of McCormick Place, and it was a big deal. We used to go and check out all the really cool stuff, and then they stopped doing it city to city, so they just do it in Vegas now, and it's a once-a-year thing, and that's why, you know, they can go for how long does it run? It runs about a week, doesn't it? At least
4 days. There is kind of a soft open on the first day, but it's mostly trade to trade stuff for the journalists, and then the Tuesday through Friday is the rest of it. And it's you know, it's gotten kind of hard to get in. It's expensive, and if you want a media pass, I was invited, luckily, so I didn't have to worry about that. But the guys I were with were both writers, and they had to kind of, you know, fight a little bit to get their credentials, but once you do, it's really worth it. And it's organized like, as you know, like a military operation.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, everything is figured out down to the last nanosecond, including the speaking schedules and who's where and what's going on. And they actually, I hadn't seen this before at things like this. They actually had people giving tours. It was like what you see in Asia, you know, holding up a blinking sign that has your tour group number on it. So they were giving attendees tours of the highlights of every hall. And I thought, that's really smart.
Yeah.
Kind of weird, but it's smart, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. But, you know, so now how did your thing go? What were you invited to do?
So there's a part of this called Gary's Book Club. Gary Shapiro was one of the founders of CES. And, you know, wonderfully, he decided he wanted to bring in kind of a softer part of the intellectual background conversation, this whole thing. So he has a stage in the center of the main hall called Gary's Book Club. And they invited in, I think, 12 authors. And most of it's, you know, organizational change or forward-looking tech thinking or how to innovate and all that. And there's one's Facebook, which was Mindspace 2.0. And I was, you know, kind of gobsmacked when I got the invite because I thought, wow, I haven't seen this before. This is cool. So they set this up for 4 o'clock today. And I figured, you know, I'd get an interviewer as part of their media operation or something. But they brought in this woman named Kara Blackwell from NASA headquarters, who is the director of their program called iTech, which is this really amazingly forward-looking, you know, because we talk about NASA, and their tech is always great, the programs are cool, but in terms of moving along to where we think a lot of other technology is, sometimes the softer parts of that feel like they're lagging behind. But this division that she runs is specifically to put together entrepreneurs with brilliant ideas that can be helpful to the kind of things that NASA does, and that, you know, includes the FAA and other things that have to do with flight and spaceflight. They put them together with investors, and they asked for nothing.
Wow.
You know, it's just one of those cool things NASA does, like monitoring climate change and telling the world all about it. So she's one of these people that you sit in the room there for 10 minutes and you think, okay, you know, my IQ is outclassed by about triple digits here,
yeah.
So that's fine. And she asked really good questions, and so we talked for about half an hour, and it was just great fun. I really, really enjoyed it.
That's great. That's really, really great. Okay, listen, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. He's a space expert, and he is out in Vegas at the Consumer Electronics Show. And we'll get more from that. And we got a whole bunch of space stuff to talk about. And any questions that you have concerning space or space-related things, 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. More after this. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. It's Wildcard Wednesday.
Yeah.
312-981-7200. Who requested the Foreigner?
That's coming to us from Mike in Old Irving Park.
Mike in Old Irving Park. A little Foreigner for you on this Wednesday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are going to talk about some weird things a little bit later on that are for sale at fast food restaurants. We got another round of Know Your Onion. That's where Tom will read you some news headlines, and you have to decide whether they are real or from The Onion. And that's all coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, and the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And right now we are talking with our good friend Rod Pyle. Rod is an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine, a space expert, and he's actually calling in from the CES right now. And let's get back to Rod. Rod, welcome back.
Hey.
All right. So we got some news stories here. Nine epic space discoveries you probably missed in 2019. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I didn't actually look at that one, Nick.
Oh, okay. Well, it's
but
let's
talk
I can tell you what they are, and you give me
your.
The cosmic web revealed. Every galaxy in the universe is a pit stop on a long way to a highway of gas known as the cosmic web.
Yeah, you know, this one, I didn't pay a lot of attention to that this year because it came when I was working on a bunch of other stuff, but the amount of things we're learning in cosmology quickly from this incredible assembly of, you know, there's the gravity wave detectors and there's the cosmic background explorer experiments and all the stuff they've been able to see in the cosmic background. And so I'm kind of dodging the question a little bit, but the overall picture of cosmology has been changing really quickly. And the one thing, though, that still seems to be lurking out there that is just baffling everybody is the whole dark matter, dark energy question. You know, this is great. We understand all this. We're learning more about the origins of the universe, and we're seeing further than we ever had before and further back in time, because, of course, the further away something is, the older it is, the light or the energy reaching us. But where's everything else that's supposed to be there? And that's really been a vexing question.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, the next thing that they mention here is the plasma shield that guards the realms of men. There is a violent clash unfolding at the frontier of our solar system. Billions of miles of the solar system's center, crackling solar winds collide with powerful cosmic rays at a boundary called the heliopause.
Yeah. So that's something that we've known about for a long time. So there's energy coming up from the sun, the solar wind, high energy, and then there's the energy coming from everything else in the galaxy and beyond that's coming in towards our solar system. I mean, it goes in all directions, but, of course, it impinges on the solar system as well. But where these things meet, this intersection between the outgoing pressure and the incoming pressure of these energies is the edge of the heliosphere, the bubble around the sun. It's portrayed as kind of this big oval blob when you look at it on a chart. And that is something that we didn't really begin to understand until the second decade of the 21st century, when the Voyager 1 made the crossing and was able to start sending back data from there. And, you know, Voyager's been out there for a lot. At that point, it had been out there, I think, for 35 years, 32 years, something like that. And because it was launched in 77. And it was confusing because it would, you know, they were looking for this shift between the solar wind energy and the energy coming from the greater cosmic, not cosmic rays, but the cosmic radiation, let's say. And they wanted to see what this boundary was looking like. And it turns out, you know, kind of thought, well, it'll be this sort of gradual shift and then this sort of demarcation, but it's not. It folds. It's kind of like a brain, like brain tissue. It folds back and forth. And you fly in and out of these things. So it was very confusing to the physicists who were looking at it. They said, okay, this is something we're going to have to study. Then they got another look at it as Voyager 2 crossed, and now they're looking at putting together, I think we talked about this last time, this so-called interstellar mission that really is less about going to another star and more about sending out something that's not, you know, 35, 40 years old, like the Voyagers. And a lot of their instrumentation has either failed or been turned off by now because their power system's very old and it's nuclear, but it does, you know, come down every year by a certain amount. So they want to send out something that's perfect, that's purpose-driven, designed for this, that will have a suite of brand-new instruments and really be able to study it very closely. And, yeah, it does protect us from the fair amount of the nasty stuff that would otherwise be coming in.
Yeah.
But even with that, you know, the solar system's just bathed in various kinds of radiation, and we're really lucky we're on the planet that has a magnetosphere that stops an awful lot of that, because if you go to Mars or the Moon, you don't have that, which is why we always talk about having to live down inside a lava tube or a tunnel or something where you've got rock overhead.
Yeah. They said, according to this little thing, it says the plasma, quote-unquote, shield, as it was described in a November 4th study, may deflect about 70% of cosmic rays from entering our solar system.
And that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting. I used to work up at Griffith Observatory, as you know.
Yeah.
And we had a cosmic ray detector tank up there, which is, you know, it's a cooled chamber with a couple of plates in it, charged plates. And so if a cosmic ray comes dashing through there, it leaves a little vapor trail for a second. It's very cool if you've never seen one. And you can stand there for 5 minutes and see, you know, 10 or 20 of these things. You realize any one of those can potentially go through and, you know, do cell damage, or if you've got a digital device that can flip a 1 to a 0 and back. It doesn't happen much on Earth, but for instance, when you get one of the rovers out on Mars, one of the reasons they all have to have at least two computer systems in them, and they're switching from bank A to bank B constantly, is because a high-energy cosmic ray will come through, and this is something that's traveled from potentially thousands and thousands of light years away, and it'll hit a specific part in the memory chip, and bing, it changes it from a 0 to 1 or the other direction, so they start fouling up and misinterpreting their data.
Mm.
So, yeah, this is another thing, you know, we keep learning. The more we learn about space, the more we realize our assumptions from back in the first half of the 20th century were just, to a large extent, not very good.
Yeah.
And it's hostile out there. So our solar system's hostile. It's got, you know, hard vacuum, radiation, temperature extremes, and all that. But this is one more thing about, okay, once you leave that solar system and start heading out to other stars, as we hope to do someday, now we've got this much bigger radiation quotient, and I think that's the discovery there. And that's something that, again, you know, if you're sending robots out, that's one thing. You can wrap them in something that'll protect them pretty easily and make them very robust. But once you start sending the meatbags out there, the human beings, it's, again, another one of those reasons why it's going to be very tough for the future to look something like The Expanse or Interstellar.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. All right. How about this? Radio bubbles in the galaxy's gut. There are twin blobs of high-energy gas ballooning out of both poles of the Milky Way's center, stretching into space for 25,000 light-years apiece.
Yeah, the core of the Milky Way galaxy has been a puzzle for a long time. We know there's a huge black hole, or possibly more than one huge black hole is there doing their nastiness, and it's a good thing they're there, because if they moved out further in the galactic arm, you start having potential for real trouble.
Yeah.
Because they're really disruptive, and I don't know that much more about it, except that they're beginning to divine more and more the structure of this. I mean, it's hard, because you're looking through a very dense part of the galaxy to look at the core, you know. You've got to look through our part of the spiral arm. And there's a lot of deductive and intuitive logic there.
All right. All right. We got a few more of these things. Really quickly, though, if you can answer this question in like 2 minutes. Can you tell us, 773 area code says, can you tell us about the red giant on Orion that might go supernova?
Don't know a thing about it.
Okay.
I mean, red dwarfs are really common stars, red giants less so, but in terms of timing on when that thing might go supernova, don't know a lot. I think one thing, though, we're going to start seeing is better and better predictions of when stars might begin to shift, if you can happen to catch the data from it. I said data, you know, the observational data from it.
Yeah.
With enough advanced timing, and you begin to be able to form some predictions of these things. So that's something to look forward to, because I would love to see a supernova. I just don't want it to be very close to Earth.
Yeah, I think everybody agrees with you on that. Okay, listen, Rod, hang on.
Okay.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us, space expert, author. We've got a lot more space stories to talk about here. And if you want to jump in with a comment or a question, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And we'll get back with Rod Pyle. We got some phone lines open. Texts are coming in. And we'll talk more with Rod about space right after we take a break for the news, which is coming up after this. Out of my dreams. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're here every weeknight and into the morning, 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. And, yeah, it's, we're live in the Skyline studio here. Wildcard Wednesday.
Yeah, Wildcard Wednesday.
Who requested Billy Ocean?
It's coming to us from Ricardo in Riverside.
Ricardo in Riverside wanted to hear a little Get Out of My Dreams and Into My Car.
That song rules, man.
Was that featured in the, I think it was it featured in the classic Corey's movie, License to Drive?
Probably.
The two Corey's? Remember when they were a thing?
No.
Oh, no.
I wasn't born yet.
But you know that they were a thing.
I know that they were a thing. And yeah. Now,
well, Corey Haim unfortunately passed away.
He did. Who's the, Corey?
Feldman.
Feldman. And he's off the rails now.
Yeah, not as, I mean, he was worse in the past.
Have you heard his album from last year?
Well, I mean, he's been in a band now for many years.
I know, but this is...
Yeah.
It's like called like Angel to Heaven or something like that. It's another time.
Yeah. Well, they used to call each other the Hamster and the Feld Dog.
Oh, God.
That were their nicknames. The Hamster and the Feld Dog. You ever see Dream a Little Dream?
I have not, no.
Okay.
I'll just file that into weird
License
80s
to ephemera, Drive.
You know,
License to Drive, one of Heather Graham's first films.
Do they play any Asia in it?
They do not.
Well, it's
because it's late 80s. It's Asia was early 80s.
That's a shame. Yeah. Missed opportunity.
I agree. Well, we're back here, and if you guys want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Our guest is Rod Pyle, good friend of the show, author, journalist, editor in chief of Ad Astra magazine, and a space expert. And if you want to jump in with any of your space questions or concerns, it's 312-981-7200. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you. So just a quick recap on the cosmic web.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were kind of circling the subject, but specifically, I guess what they were talking about was hydrogen streamers, and you may have mentioned that. So the idea here is that it's long been suspected that that would be out there, because there are clouds of hydrogen blocking a lot of the observations they'd love to do, and you need to look at specific wavelengths to get past them, because optically they can be kind of a problem.
Okay.
So this was a photograph taken, take the part, again, this is part of that detective work astronomers do. They found an area where there was enough backlight from a distant galaxy to illuminate these things from behind, so they could photograph them. And when I say, you know, they're out there, we're talking 12 billion light years. And the universe is only about 13.7 billion years old, we think. So this is going back, you know, because light takes time to travel, this is looking back almost to the origins of the universe.
Yeah.
So this is post-Big Bang, you know, in the big scheme of things, a billion and a half years is not a whole lot. Post-Big Bang connective tissue, if you will, these filaments between the galaxies, which, again, if you're a brilliant person and you reverse engineer this scanty data you're looking at, can start telling you more about how all this formed, because it's again, it's astonishing what still isn't known, despite all this incredible technology we have. So when they get more telescopes up, probably in space, because it's difficult to look through the atmosphere and to be able to also look through these clouds, we'll probably have a big shift. So, for instance, the Webb, you know, the James Webb telescope, when that goes up, should be able to get more data on this. So it's one of those emerging stories. So, yeah, it was a good choice.
Okay. All right. We got a bunch more space stories to talk about. We also have some phone lines open, and if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Here's Lulu on WGN. Go ahead, Lulu.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. My favorite program.
Thank you.
My question is this. A couple months ago, astronomers were picking up meteorites that were coming close to Earth, but had no, there was no danger of us getting hit. But what if they catch something that's close to the space station or something that's really important? Can they get out of the way, or is it just going to be doomsday?
That's a very good question. It's part of the space station's original design, this big power and propulsion element that the Russians built and we put up early. And it was actually, they had designed it to replace their old Mir space station, but we used it for the ISS. So there's already, I mean, besides meteorites, there's tons of junk. We've talked about this before on the show, tons of junk just floating around in Earth orbit, and a lot of it's at the same altitude as the space station. So every now and then, every couple of months, something's coming along that's big enough, and it doesn't have to be that large. I mean, something the size of a marble could cause major problems, even smaller. So if the Air Force sees it, because the Air Force does all this tracking, they tell NASA, and if it's on a collision course, they actually move the whole space station out of the way. And it's not a trivial process, because it's very big, and it's kind of delicate, and you don't want to move too fast, because you'll torque things, and they can break off. So it's a big deal. Meteors are also a problem. I'm not sure which group you're talking about. There was a shower that came in December. That's one of the ones, big ones, comes in every year, the Orionids. So it may have been that. And, you know, these things, most of them are, when you're talking about a shower, a cluster like that, it's because the Earth is crossing the path of an old defunct comet, and it leaves a lot of gravel and junk in its wake. And most of the particles are the size of a grain of sand, so they're just going to impact a hull and either bounce off or just embed themselves there. But some are brighter, which is why you see, when there's a meteor shower, you see remnants. And if you're willing to stay up all night, which is tough in December in Chicago, I imagine. But if it's clear and the moon's down, you could see, you know, sometimes three of these things every minute. And some of them are very bright. Occasionally you see what they call a bolide or a fireball, which could be anything from the size of, I'll say, a ping pong ball up to maybe a softball, and they make quite a show. So it doesn't have to be very big to make a big splash in the atmosphere, and certainly doesn't have to be very big to hurt the space station. So yeah, they got to be really careful.
Yeah. Okay, Lulu.
Very good. Thank you so much.
There you go. We've talked a lot. Lulu. We talked a lot about that. All the junk that's out there floating around.
Yeah, and we've talked about this too, but it bears repeating. There was an incident. I mean, ever since the beginning in the late 50s, they were sending these robots out. They had micrometeoroid detectors on them because they wanted to know, you know, how much of this junk is out there in orbit and in open space. And there was, of course, you know, nothing man-made around Earth at that point. Now there's millions of bits that have come from exploded boosters and so forth. And not that many years ago, a shuttle mission was in orbit, and it was flying windshield first, and they were impacted by a pink flake about the size of a dime, and it left a great big shattered divot in the front window. Fortunately, the windows are quartz glass, and they're really hard, and there was four or five layers of them. But had it just been that one layer, it could have been a very bad day. So, yeah, it doesn't take much moving at those speeds to impart a lot of energy.
Yeah. All right. We got another space thing here from this story about the probably missed discoveries. Fermi's chimneys? Know anything about that?
Nope.
It says, at the center, the center of our galaxy is a supermassive black hole. This object's monstrously powerful gravity is sort of like the glue that holds the Milky Way together. Earlier this year, researchers discovered that the glue is letting off fumes. In a March 20th study...
Right, the hot plasma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It says...
well, we see that in other star systems. I mean, you can see systems that they think have a black hole or something of that nature in the center, and you see these two big streamers going out to the sides. And you look at that, you think, you know, if our planet happened to be in that galaxy and that thing swept past us, you're probably done.
Mm.
So they're kind of scary, but usually they're going out at the perpendicular directions to the planet of the galaxy, at least the ones I've seen, so it's not that big a deal.
Okay.
But, yeah, this is, again, one of those kind of discomforting things that come out of this nasty big black hole at the center of the galaxy that we don't know that much about.
Yeah. And how about solar tsunamis?
Solar tsunamis. This was something from the Parker, right?
Yeah. Parker Solar Probe. They did a study that came months earlier in February, according to scientists. The researchers described a solar phenomenon called basically cataclysmic magnetic field collisions at the sun's equator.
Yeah. So... if you ever have a chance to go to an observatory or a science museum that has a solar telescope that can observe through certain wavelengths, and you look close at the surface, especially if you can see something time-lapse, a shot through there, you can see the sun is, you know, not just this big ball as we see it in the sky with the naked eye. It's this really nasty, there's all kinds of turbulent activity. Sunspots aren't really dark spots. They're just spots that are cooler than the rest of it, so they look black because they're against this intensely bright background. But there's all kinds of magnetic storms and weird stuff happens inside the sun, part of what causes coronal actions and flutters that we see at the time. So my understanding of this was just a new understanding of how violent those magnetic storms are and how they interact with each other.
Yeah.
And I think what's remarkable about it is just discovering how complex and really unsettled the sun is and how fortunate we are that we happen to live near one that doesn't do too many nasty things. Because it doesn't take much.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen with what's happening with climate change, you start getting a little more solar energy and you raise the temperature by a couple of degrees, drop it by a couple of degrees, and you have either an ice age or this big heating event. So you really want to be next to a stable star. So in a way, learning more about what's going on inside is a little uncomfortable because it's like, oh, it's really a violent place and something bad could happen. But
right.
The good news is it doesn't. And as we understand more, they're able to predict new things. How much we'd be able to do about it? You know, if there's a spacecraft out beyond Earth orbit, it's good to know what might be coming because you want to be able to tell those guys, okay, you got to get in the radiation shield, the storm locker for,
right.
You know, how many hours or days. But in terms of stuff that's planet affecting, you know, get in your basement.
All right, Rod, hang on.
Get out the pork and beans.
There
All right.
You go. Rod, get out the pork and beans. Rod Pyle is with us. Author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. If you guys have any questions or comments that involve space or space-related issues, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. More with Rod after this.
Glamour, glamour, lead us less too far, we wonder. Love, sweet voices calling yonder. Shine, little glowworm, glimmer, glimmer. Hey there, don't get dimmer, dimmer. Light the the path below above can lead us on to love.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. as we are every weekday morning, night into the morning, 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. Our good friends over at Bradley Place at WGN-TV, the early morning news, will be broadcast from 4 to 5. And then Bob Surratt is our morning drive host. It's Wildcard Wednesday.
Yeah.
Any artist, any song, anything, 312-981-7200. Is the number for requests. And if you have any questions about space or space-related issues, 312-981-7200. We're going to get back to our conversation with Rod Pyle. Who requested that?
That was from Carol. It's The Glowworm.
Yes.
By the Mills Brothers.
Yes, classic.
Very fun.
Classic, The Glowworm. All right, we are back here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Rod Pyle, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. We're talking space. And Rod, welcome back.
Thanks. So I have a question for you.
Okay.
Have you watched season 4 of The Expanse yet?
I have not.
Okay. Then
tell me
about... I guess I don't have a question.
Well, no. Have you watched it?
So, yeah. So I had to devour it the first week because this was the first season of Amazon's, you know, ownership in terms of creation and production. And that happened at an NSS conference is when Bezos said, okay, we're picking up your show, and everybody got hysterical, and the organization got more PR than they had ever had in their lives in about 30 seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
That's everybody tweeting it out. And so I was really looking forward to it. So it's pretty clear. It looks to me like they've cranked the budget up a fair amount. But the storyline, without giving anything away, got kind of planet-bound, and it reminded me, and not I'm not impugning it at all, but it reminded me a little bit of, if you remember the original Lost in Space, after season one, there was no more cool spaceflight stuff. It was all, oh, we're on another planet that looks like the high desert of California, because that's, of course, where they shot it.
Yeah.
So they did well with it, but it felt a little planet-bound. But still, you know, every time these guys are in space, their attention to detail, and they interviewed Kaz Anvar, who plays Alex, the pilot, a few months ago. And, you know, so he's one of the better scientific minds on the crew, on the cast. And then, of course, the guys who produce the show are very into this and quite smart. But, you know, the fact that somebody finally designed a show where spacecraft accelerate halfway to where they got to go and then turn around and decelerate the other half of the way. Uh-huh. And if something goes wrong, you're going to fly past your target, and that's bad. And all the zero-G and the magnetic boots, I mean, their attention to detail is just so exquisite, even to the point that, you know, if they're drinking a fluid and they don't finish it, that doesn't go back down the straw afterwards like it did in 2001. That was kind of an oops moment. Mm. It's just really cool. So, and that kind of ties in a very vague way into the space cookie story that you guys sent me, but we could talk about that later.
Yeah, okay. But, you know, you mentioned Lost in Space. Did you watch that when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed to say yes.
Oh, I did too. I watched it religiously, and I just you know, it was funny how, and I've talked about this before on the air. It's so funny how the character of Dr. Smith changed. Like he was supposed to be a villain, and he kind of played it that way, and then it just became completely over the top ham comedy acting.
Yeah, with this really kind of weird effeminate sort of overtone that I remember as a young man thinking, something off here, you know, and I can't quite figure out what they're getting at. Now, the original pilot did not have Dr. Smith. I have a copy of it, and it is unbelievably glacially boring because it's just the nice people of Space Family Robinson. And, you know, Dr. Robinson is brilliant about this, and his wife June was a brilliant astronomer, astrophysicist, or something. My favorite is daughter Judy, who left a promising career in acting to go to space with her family, which you would have never guessed by watching her on the show. But there was no Dr. Smith, so then they redid the pilot with Smith and broadcast that, as you remember.
Yeah.
And you're right, for the first 2-3 episodes, he's this really bad guy who's interesting because he's there to sabotage the ship for an, quote, unnamed enemy power, obviously the Soviet Union. And then he turns into this kind of blithering idiot.
Yeah.
Constantly running from one thing to another and getting Will in trouble. And you're thinking, why would you do that? I think it all comes down. I knew a guy who directed a bunch of those episodes. And I asked him years later, I said, so what was the deal there? And he said, you know, it literally got to the point where he wrote the scripts around whatever was sitting around. And they were so low budget, they would actually go around the studio scrounging dumpsters for prop items and costume items. And when I asked him why, with the pretty prominent career he had as a TV director, he did Lost in Space, he said, alimony. And I said, okay. Can't argue with that.
Yeah, yeah, that's the reason for a lot of people. We were just talking about the career of Nicolas Cage and, you know, about how many movies he's made and how many terrible movies he's made. And you know, but you got to pay some, I guess you got to pay back bills. So,
yeah.
But I remember watching Lost in Space, and even as a kid, I was like, man, this is a cheap show, you know, because the sets were just so bad. And then, you know, like you were just saying, they're raiding dumpsters for props and stuff like that. And you can tell when you watch it. But you know what? I still have a soft spot in my heart for the show. And, you know, and I do watch it. They run it here on a local station. And I do watch it, and it brings back a lot of fun memories, even though it's, like, not good.
Yeah, and you're kind of okay until you see the episode with the Carrot Man.
Yeah.
Which is a big styrofoam carrot with a hole cut out for a bit part actor in it.
Right, right.
Or my favorite was the two aliens. This was towards the end of the series. Clearly, this week they were just out of budget. So they wore black drop claws over their heads and white sequin top hats. And I thought, you know, I'm just a kid, but this is really lame.
Right.
So the new series, you've seen some of those, right?
Yeah. And I really like what they did with Dr. Smith. I like that it's Parker Posey.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. And the robot, of course, is great.
Right.
But it did, again, feel to me like it got a little bogged down. You know, now they're trying to be more socially relevant, planetary politics, and, you know, self-determination of gender identity and all this kind of stuff. And that's fine, but it felt like they were really trying to push it into the cookie mold a little bit too much, I thought.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that, you know, like a lot of these sci-fi series that we see now are taking a cue from the incredible popularity and a critical acclaim of Battlestar Galactica. You know, which was much more than just a sci-fi show. There was a lot more going on, and I think a lot of people are trying to take a cue from that.
And boy, dark. I lasted with, I worked on it. Then they went off to Vancouver, and that's the end of the effects job. But with watching it until, I can't remember the guy, his right-hand guy, had to kill his wife for being a spy.
Yeah. Hold on a second. You're breaking up. Rod, hang on. You're breaking up. Why don't we take Let's do a commercial break here, okay? We'll do a commercial. Rod, hang on. We'll fix up the technical stuff because he keeps breaking up. We want to make sure we got a good, strong phone line for Rod so that we continue talking to him. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. I always have a lot of fun. We got more space issues to talk about. We also talk about sci-fi and all kinds of cool stuff with Rod. We'll get him back on the line and get that phone line fixed, and we'll get more with Rod Pyle after this at 312-981-7200. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio, and it's Wild Card Wednesday.
Yeah,
it's any artist, any song, anything. Coming up, we're going to be talking about some strange stuff that's being sold in fast food restaurants. We got another round of Know Your Onion. That's where Tom will read you a news headline, and you have to guess whether it's real or it's from the satirical newspaper The Onion, and then you win prizes. And it's Wild Card Wednesday. Who requested that? What was that?
So that was Neil Young.
Oh, right.
When he did his very strange album, Trans.
Yeah, that was from Trans.
Yeah, and looking for who requested. The text kind of is back in there, but we'll let you know.
All right, we'll figure it out. Okay, Wildcard Wednesday continues, 312-981-7200. And our conversation with Rod Pyle continues, author, journalist, and editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. We're talking space, and we always talk sci-fi and all that cool stuff. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks. So we'll try again. I relocated.
Yeah. Now, we were talking about Lost in Space before. We were talking
Battlestar
about
Galactica.
Battlestar Galactica. Yes, yeah. Battlestar Galactica. And you knew the people you worked on it.
Yeah. So I worked on it for about 9 months to a year before they really got into the heavy part of production. So we're just doing pre-visualization stuff. So it's like, okay, what's a Viper look like? How's it move? How's it going to fly? How's it fly relative to the Battlestar? It kind of helped trying to figure out what the Battlestar was going to look like, because they were just all over the map. And I remember the guy I was working for, who was the main visual effects guy, Gary Hutzel, came back from meeting at the studio one day. We had our office set up in Pasadena.
Yeah.
And he walked in. He was just pissed off, you know. And I said, Gary, what's the deal? He said, well, we had another design meeting on the ship today. And I said, and? They want it to look like it was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And I thought, that's kind of cool. Wait a minute. And, you know, and there's a lineage back to the original Battlestar, even if it's a reboot. We kind of like the old alligator nose Battlestar.
Yeah, so
And that's the direction they finally went. But there was a lot of, I'm just glad it didn't go off in some direction like, let's make it look like the starship from Passengers, which was too goofy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was designed, I think I told you before, the designer did a write-up on him, and they had gone back. And this is a problem for shows like this and movies. That designer went back and looked at every spaceship from Jules Verne forward to last week in sci-fi. And he said, the director and I couldn't agree on anything. So I went home, I saw a sycamore pod fall off, seed pod fall off of a tree in my backyard. And I said, that's it. And that's how we got those weird spiral arms. And I don't get it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what works for him.
Yeah. All right. You know, you mentioned the cookie story. Let's talk about that. For the holidays, astronauts baked cookies in space, but they won't actually eat.
Yeah. So the idea here is they're trying to figure out how to make space a more habitable place, happy habitable place for people over the long term. So of course there's radiation to worry about, bone density, and all, you know, air to breathe, and all the things you got to worry about. But there's also comfort items because you know, a journey to Mars, 5, 6, 7 months. Is, depending on how fast you're going and how you're getting there, is a long time. And you're locked up in a tin can, probably something the size of a large RV or smaller. And you want to have some comforts there. So besides making sure that they've got a window and some relaxing music and all that, they were thinking, well, you know, home cooking is important. We can't just keep kind of using these prefab meals we send up for the space station if we want people to be happy.
Yeah.
So one item was baking. And you know, you don't think about it. Well, yeah, you make some cookie dough and you bake it. What's the big deal? Well, when you have a normal oven, it works whether it's a burner or an oven inside. It works because heat rises, right?
Right.
So you have burners below if it's in the oven or open burners below the pots on the top. But in space, it just forms this big bubble of heat. So they had to design a cylindrical oven that had heater elements all the way around. So they sent up pre-mixed cookie dough. And they did this experiment and then had to pack all the cookies up to send them home, A, because you don't want to eat cookie dough that isn't cooked completely, and B, they want the culinary people down at NASA on Earth to be able to evaluate how thoroughly we were cooked and is this something that will work. But I thought it was kind of – I was glad you said that because it's kind of a cool little tech story of the kind of stuff that just doesn't occur to us. It's like, you know, so cooking works one direction with gravity in terms of heat rising. And, you know, space toilets work in a different direction with gravity because you want things to fall down.
Right.
So in that case, you have to figure out another way using the spinning receiver and all that kind of stuff. So it's complicated being up there.
Yeah. No, there's no question about it. I love that. Now, so they sent the cookies back?
Yeah. Well, they're going to send it back.
Oh, they're going to send it back. I was going to say, because I wanted to know what the results were.
Well, they said that they turned out okay. They had a little time getting the cooking time right, because, of course, you can't really test this on Earth very well because we've got gravity.
Yeah.
And there's no way to defy that. So they set it up and used a spread of cooking times, but they said on the last couple of batches it looked like it was pretty thoroughly cooked and the chocolate chips melted and all the things they want. And sort of cool, the ingredients and the recipe came from the Doubletree Hotel, which is famous for leaving those chocolate chip cookies on your pillow.
Oh, I see.
That's a nice touch.
Oh, okay.
Kind of, you know, Doubletree is owned by Hilton, and that kind of harkens back to 2001, the space Hilton in orbit and all that. And I thought, well, that's kind of a nice loop around.
Yeah. Oh, that's a pretty cool story. All right. We got a text here. A couple of texts have come in, Rod.
So,
it's still 9 years away. We will be able to see Apophis with the naked eye.
I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. All right.
So buy a telescope or binoculars to be sure. But in 8 years, I'll be able to tell you for sure.
Okay. All right. We'll wait for that then. 815 area code says, when will the next Skylab happen? Junk come crashing back to Earth. Also, what are the possibilities of a return trip to the moon? Well, we talk about this stuff pretty frequently. You can answer that.
Yeah, so the second one, you know, we were aiming for 2028. Then Trump said, no, I want it by 2024. you know, ostensibly the end of his second term, if. And so NASA, you know, put on the gas, informed the European partners, said, look, we're going to have to do most of this on our own because you guys aren't going to be ready. We understand that. So they kind of brought a lot of it back in-house to try and make the landings by 2024. That was going to require more money. The head of NASA asked for a larger budget, and he got it this year, but the allocations were spread out in such a way that they got most of what they wanted, but they were shorted by almost half on the money they need to design new lunar lander. So they still put out the contracts, but here's this thing again where, you know, we come up with these ambitious programs, you make these announcements, and then Congress doesn't fund them to the extent that they need. So Congress was generous with the overall budget, but they allocated it to other areas. And, you know, there's a lot of acrimony over the SLS, the Space Launch System, because it's big and it's expensive, and Boeing's been having problems getting it right, and it's taking a lot longer than we wanted. And a lot of that money keeps going to that, but it's built in a number of powerful states with powerful senators, and that keeps it going. So it looks like overall we may miss the 2024 deadline, and it could be 25 or 26 by the time it happens, because in total, they need at least another $20 billion to get it right on top of what they're already getting. Mm. Part of that's because the space station keeps soaking up, I think, $2.5 to $3.5 billion a year to keep that going. So it's a big, involved, difficult kind of calculation, and they, you know, something's going to have to give, whether it's decommissioning the space station early or just putting off the moon landing. But we're pretty committed to going back. What was the other question? Space junk.
Yeah, space junk, yeah.
So we don't currently have anything in orbit that looks like it'll come back out of control. We recently saw the first Chinese space station, Tiangong-1, come back out of control because they had lost contact with it and weren't able to program the deorbit burn. Luckily it came down the Pacific Ocean. Most of the Earth is covered with water, so that's good for us because
yeah.
It means it's more likely to come down the ocean. We don't want radioactive fuel coming back because that's very toxic. It's usually plutonium or something like it. And there's still a couple of Russian satellites, as I recall, that are orbiting up around there that are defunct and have nuclear power supplies. So that's something that has kind of got eyebrows cocked. But in general, as far as I know, there's nothing large planned to come back in the next 4 or 5 years. That doesn't mean that a foreign power won't put up something that, you know, we'll not have control over.
Right.
And that's not something NASA can do anything about. That's each nation has their own sovereign rights to do what they want. We just hope they play nice.
Right. Okay. You know, do you remember how big the Skylab thing was? I mean, it was such a monster. The whole, like, Skylab, where's it going to fall? Where's it going to land?
Yeah, the station was like 80 feet by 22, I think. It was the size of the upper stage of the Saturn. You know, and mostly not that thick of metal, because the fuselage was not enormously heavy, because obviously it couldn't be. But certain parts of it were. So there was that fuel tank that came back. I think that hit in Australia.
Yeah.
The other parts that hit in Australia and some that were recovered later. And, you know, the good thing is none of these things are very aerodynamic because they're not designed to fly in an atmosphere. So they tend to break up. But when the Columbia Space Shuttle broke up over Texas and the South Central States,
yeah,
some fairly big parts of that came down. Fortunately, it came in an area that wasn't densely populated for the most part and didn't hurt people. But recently, the Chinese had a launch of one of the Long March rockets where a part of a stage malfunctioned, and it came back. And this particular launch facility is inland. Not sure why they did that. And they came back and flattened a rural house. And we never got much news about, you know, was there anybody in there? Were there people around there? But, you know, these villagers are doing their thing next to their mud huts, and suddenly, bang, this massive thing slams into it. And their upper stages have what are called hypergolic fuels that are very toxic. So then you also get this cloud of toxic gas spreading out. So, yeah, it's a concern, both coming from orbit and heading up.
Yeah. The Skylab thing was so big, Rod, that one of our legendary local radio personalities, Tom, I don't know if you know this or not, Steve Dahl, one of our legendary radio guys, he was a morning man during the time when the Skylab thing was happening in the news, and he did a parody song.
Oh, yeah, I've heard the song.
He did a parody song to a parody of Shattered by the Rolling Stones. But he did it as Skylab. So that's how big a thing it was. It made the Morning Zoo guys in Chicago do a parody song about it.
Well, you know, the only big radio personality in Chicago, in my book, is Nick DiGiulio.
Oh, well, that's kind of... Do we have a little bit of it, Tom? Yeah, here's a little bit of this parody song, right?
Okay.
They say it'll drop the scene, that it won't kill you or me. I don't believe them. Melted bodies, burning hair, and flaming metal everywhere.
So there it is. There's a little bit of that.
That's pretty harsh. You know, there's one little bit more to that story, which is the plan was as Skylab, the orbit was slowly decaying, and they weren't sending any more crews up. But the plan was to have the shuttle go up and boost it to a higher orbit so it could either be disposed of properly or preferably used again, because there was nothing wrong with it. When they left it for the last time in the mid-70s, they buttoned everything up and, you know, took the trash out and everything. So it was ready to go again. It would just need a little bit of refilling in certain tools and consumables. But the shuttle program got delayed so long, and we had a larger energy solar cycle that the end of the 70s than we expected. So that caused the Earth's atmosphere to expand a little bit, and that was just enough to increase the drag between that and the shuttle being late. Mm. That's why it came back.
Okay.
So they did plan for it, but it just didn't work out.
Didn't work out that way. All right. Here's Paul on WGN. Go ahead, Paul.
I'd like to see a drone fly on the moon.
Well, you're going to have to take up some air for it to fly in. Because they're propeller driven, they do have designs on the drawing board for gas powered ones, which, you know, we do thrusters. So it's kind of almost like a lander with extra stall maneuvering jets to be able to drive around. And then people are considering and designing those as hoppers. But yeah, traditional drone would have trouble because there's no air.
Yeah, there's no air.
I thought there was like a real thin air.
No, there's kind of a tiny amount of molecular atmosphere, but it's really like nothing. In terms of enough to do that. The one place, however, where we are going to see drones in use is Saturn's moon Titan, which actually has an atmosphere denser than Earth's. So they've got a project called Dragonfly that they're going to set up there, and it's got, I think it's an octorotor, so I think it's got eight, and it's going to be able to fly these hops of almost a mile at a time, maybe more, to be able to explore different regions. So it'll fly and land and fly and land and fly and land. It's got a nuclear fuel supply. So that'll be really exciting. And that's like drone perfect weather there.
There you go. All right, Paul, thanks for the call. By the way, anytime you mention Titan, I think of Kurt Vonnegut every single time.
The sirens of Titan.
Oh, yeah. All right. Rod, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us, and we'll come back and talk more with Rod, conclude that. And then after three, we're going to talk about some really weird stuff being sold in fast food restaurants, and then we've got another round of Know Your Onion after 3:30. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we'll have more with this after this. Oh, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here till 4 a.m., and then we've got our friends over at Bradley Place WGN TV side for their local early morning news. We'll hear that from 4 to 5, and then at 5 o'clock, Bob Surratt comes in as your morning drive. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. We're talking space and all kinds of other cool stuff. And Rod, welcome back.
Hi, and I've got some answers about Apophis.
Okay.
So it looks like the next close flyby will be in 2029. There's no impact danger. There was one in 2036 that they were worried about an impact danger, but that's been ruled out. It's about 1,200 feet. It's dark. So from everything I've been able to find, they're going to have to use radar and telescopes to see it, so it will not be a naked eye object.
Won't be able to see it then.
But I should be more clear. Amateur astronomers and the public at large should be able to see it as a star near the Little Dipper, but you're just talking about a point of light. So if you want to actually see any detail, you're going to need a telescope.
Okay.
Big one.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, we've been talking about science fiction and Isaac Asimov, 100th birthday. What kind of impact has Isaac Asimov made in the world of science fiction? Huge.
Well, interestingly, he didn't write a book a year because nobody does that when they're, you know, 2 years old. But he wrote 100 books by 1969, which I mean, I've only written 17. That was a lot of work. I have no idea how he did it. As you know, he was incredibly influential in this genre. And it's interesting because I always found, I liked his science writing a lot. I found his science fiction to be kind of cool to the touch.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, kind of like Arthur C. Clarke's was, but even a little more, the people felt kind of remote, you know. So if you read the Foundation books, it was a fascinating study of society and politics and what future offers societies or on Earth, but in the offered age, societies were going to be like, and it brought in this idea of using sociology and mathematics to predict, you know, future patterns of behavior, kind of like we're doing with AI now, which is a little scary. So that was certainly a pivotal thing, but I guess the big one was the Three Laws of Robotics, which came from a couple of books, iRobot and another one, which was also, I'm sure you saw it, famously made into an Outer Limits, very good Outer Limits episode.
Yeah,
back in the 60s. And, you know, it really, I mean, in three simple sentences, he kind of sums up all the things necessary for a robot to behave properly and be effective in society, but safe for people. And I think, for me anyway, that's the thing I really remember most about him. But he was born in the Soviet Union, which I didn't realize.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
And yeah, he immigrated here when he was two because his father said, okay, these Bolsheviks are bad news, let's go. And there's another one of these stories that remind me of how ineffective I would probably be as a father in those circumstances. I mean, I've been effective as a father in my cushy Western existence growing up in the 20th century. But his father came here penniless, gave up everything, took every job he could to give his kids this break, and one of them turned out to be this brilliant, brilliant writer.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, I want to mention that in 1977, he founded the Asimov's Science Fiction magazine, which was a
right.
very, very popular magazine.
Yeah, and we all read it, and it was great, along with Analog, which had some connective tissue with his work as well. And sadly, I also didn't realize that he died of HIV from a bad transfusion in 1982.
Mm.
Which I hadn't realized.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. And you mentioned iRobot. Boy, did they make a bad movie out of that.
Well, Will Smith, we need to say more. No, he's done some good stuff. But, yeah, it. So here we go. You know, it didn't reach the heights of horror that Interstellar did for me.
But, sorry. It's the monthly mention of Interstellar, okay.
Well, you're waiting, right?
Yeah.
I thought it was, it certainly didn't do the book justice, but I thought it was an engaging movie to watch.
Yeah.
It just got a little silly at times, I guess is the best way to put it.
Have there been, like, really great science fiction adaptations of books? I mean, 2001, well, obviously 2001 is great, but it's, you know, and it's you know.
Except when you saw it as a kid, I was there, first half, I'm with them, man. They're going up the space station, they're taking that great shuttle to the moon, and then they get a discovery, and they're going to Jupiter and all that. And then that ending sequence, and I thought, WTF just happened here.
Yeah.
I was really baffled, because I was, you know, 10 years old or something, and I didn't do LSD.
Right, right,
ever,
right.
But especially
right.
not that age. So that ending, you know, why is this guy eating a poached egg in China and what?
Right.
That was really puzzling. They kind of left me in the dust with that. But, yeah.
You know, I don't think you had to be 10 years old to be puzzled by the ending of 2001.
Well, and then I finally read the original story. I think it was The Sentinel. And it made a lot more sense.
Yeah.
You know, the space baby at the end and all that.
Yeah.
But without that, you're thinking, what's this creepy white fetus doing looking at the planet and why? And it's got this kind of strange half smile, Mona Lisa smile on its face.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this is a TV series, but I think The Expanse, again, is one of the most faithful, I was talking to Tom before we got in the air, faithful adaptations of a book I've ever seen. So I watched all four seasons, and then I thought, you know, I missed some stuff. So I went back, started reading the novel.
We were going to wrap up the conversation in just a couple of minutes, but I want to get Rod back on. We still got a few minutes to talk to him. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. We got a couple of more minutes with Rod, and you can check him out. By the way, I want to plug his website, rodpilebooks.com. And if you want to check out his books, he's got a ton of books that are available. He said he's written 17. And I've got a bunch of them here, and they're all really, really good. So Rod's a great guy. Can we get him back in time, or are we going to lose him for... We got him? All right.
Yeah,
Rod, welcome back.
I don't know. Somebody didn't like what I was talking about.
I guess. Well, we were talking about Expanse and how, you know, you went back and watched it because it was so it was one of the most faithful adaptations you'd had seen.
Yeah, and so the first time around, I wasn't crazy about the Miller character. I didn't get the whole gumshoe on Space Station thing. I thought, you know, if I wanted this, I'd watch Outland, because that's Sean Connery.
Right.
But once you realize where it's headed, and you shouldn't have to know that to enjoy it, but between reading the book and rewatching it, it's like, okay, this really is very engaging. So I thought made it much more satisfying doing it that way.
God, I'm so glad that you mentioned Outland. I love that movie.
I did too, and it kind of I felt like it didn't get its full due.
Oh, I agree.
Came out.
I agree. And
who directed it?
Peter Himes.
Peter Himes.
Yeah,
but he didn't get his full due either, and he did 2010, right?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, and the thing about Outland is, one of the reasons I loved it was because it was like very cool sci-fi, but it was also High Noon in space.
Yes,
that's essentially what
so.
It was. It was High Noon in space, and I thought that was a really cool concept. And Sean Connery's great.
Yeah, and a lot of people criticize it for being High Noon in space, but I thought it was more fun to watch than High Noon for a whole bunch of reasons, Sean Connery being one of them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, how long can you stare at Gary Cooper doing his one or two different emotions? And, you know, the more I watched Outland as I got older, the more I thought, this is really a fine movie, because it just, you know, there's so much human nature playing in this story, and the crooked cops, and, you know, I'm sorry I have to do this to you, but you got in the way and all that.
Yeah.
And the way Connery kind of weaves his way through those difficulties was just great. Yeah, and so now I want to watch it again.
I know.
And we're going to watch that together.
Yeah, from 1979, which we were talking about, 1979 was actually a really strong year for movies, especially genre movies. We were talking about, like, horror films and genre films that came out in 1979, and that's another one came out, like, right? It came out at the same time as Alien. So you had a choice between two really terrific sci-fi movies in the theater.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Outland came out in 81?
Yeah, 1980. Outland, directed by Peter Himes. Yeah, 1981.
Oh, why did I think it was 79? Well, it was close. It was only a couple of years off.
A couple years off.
Yeah. Man. Well, anyway.
So what about the first Star Trek movie for you?
Now, we talked about, I'm not crazy about the first Star Trek movie. I thought it was okay, but I love, I love Wrath of Khan. I mean, that just goes without saying.
It played on the best available strengths of all the actors, which were not always as robust as we would have liked. But I thought, and Nicholas Meyer wrote that script in 12 days.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So the studio had called him, and they got in communication, and they said, look, you know, first movie had some trouble. We don't have much money. You got to write it fast. We're not going to pay you for the script. He said, I'll do it for nothing. Just give me a shot.
Yeah.
And he banged that thing out and did a fine job of directing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He also wrote Four, didn't he? The whale movie?
I think so.
Yeah. I'm pretty
and
sure.
I don't remember, but Nimoy directed that one.
Right. Yes, he did.
Five, somebody brought that up today, and I can't even think about it because it makes my brain hurt. And I remember I was working on something related to sci-fi at the time. A friend of mine was doing TNG. And he brought home some dailies from that, so we watched these VHS tapes of the outtakes and the camera coverage together.
Yeah,
and Shatner was just a beast.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Every scene, he's like, "Close up on me, close on me. Don't get them in the background. Close on me."
Rod, I got to. I'm sorry, Rod, I got to run because we have to hit the news. But I appreciate it. We'll talk to you next month, and everybody, Rod Pyle, always a pleasure. We'll talk to you next time. Okay.
Thanks so much.
Okay, buddy. There you go, Rod Pyle. Let's take a break, and we get the news up next.